Hi everyone, welcome back. Jeff Sachs here with Masechet Ta'anit from Web Yeshiva and Mishkan Sipora in Efrat. Apologies for our long absence. I was traveling the world, but I managed to go and come back without getting sick. I did, however, record a number of what I call mini shiurim in order to make some progress in the Gemara, and not to fall too far behind. I recorded, I think, four different mini shiurim, which you can get here. I'm going to send the link. Here's the link to we partner with yutorah.org. And they house the recordings of all the shiurim. There have been 84 shiurim so far on Masechet Ta'anit, and the last four were these mini shiurim that were recorded just to try to make some time. If you haven't had a chance to listen to them, so then you can catch up in those archives. But tonight we are towards the bottom of Daf Kuf Tet Omud Aleph 29A. Towards the bottom, the first wide line. The Gemara is still discussing the things described in the Mishnah that happened first on Shavuos B'Tammuz and then on Tisha B'Av. So the Mishnah says that on Tisha B'Av, Nechrasha Ha'ir, the city was plowed over. This was a common tactic of conquering armies. They would plow under the city to both show their dominance over the entire. I'm sorry, one second. Sorry about that. The conquering army would plow over the city, both as a sign of their dominance, but also to generally impoverish the populace, because the crops would then take a while before they could come back. So Tanya, when Turnus Rufus, who was the governor, the provincial governor of the land of Israel in the times of the Roman conquest, this Turnus Rufus, who we call in Chazal called Turnus Rufus Harosha, was Quintus Tinius Rufus, who died at around 131. 131 CE, 131 after zero. So he was there. He postdates the Churban, I believe. Notice he died relatively young by our standards. He was the governor, you know, around the time of the Mered Bar Kokhba. So when he plows over the city. So first he had plowed over the spot of the Makom HaMikdash, of the Heichal. Nigzera gzera al Rabban Gamliel lahariga. And at that time, they passed a decree against Rabban Gamliel that he should be executed. Ba oto hegmon. A certain Roman hegmon is like a, you know, he had some position. He was a Roman leader of the Roman authorities at that time. V'amad b'veit ha-midrash. And he comes to the Beis Medrash. V'amar bal ha-chotei mitbakesh. Bal ha-chotei mitbakesh. He says, the guy with the nose, the man with the nose, bal ha-chotei, is wanted. Shamar Rabban Gamliel azat shaminayu. And Rabban Gamliel hears this, and he goes off into hiding. So this hegmon kind of, you know, let the word out that Rabban Gamliel should run away. So why is Rabban Gamliel called the Bal HaChotem, the guy with the schnoz? Who was that actor that had the big nose?
Jimmy Durante.
Jimmy Durante. What was his nickname?
Schnoz.
The schnoz. So what does this Roman officer mean by coming into the Beis Medrash and say, The schnoz better run for it. So Balach HaTemi, either maybe Rabbi Gamliel actually had a Jimmy Durante size Cyrano de Bergerac. So Jimmy Durante size nose. Maybe that was a nickname. If so, it's not so mechubad. Rashi here says Bal Koma Vitsura, right? Gadol Hador. Balach HaTemi, as implausible as it seems to our contemporary idiom, and I was puzzled. I was unable to come up with an equivalent idiom in English. Balach HaTem, the one with the nose, is an idiom for the Gadol Hador, for the Jewish leader of the generation, the greatest rabbi of the generation. Maybe that has something to do with the idea that the nose is maybe the most distinct feature on the face. You know, maybe it's because the nose kind of leads the way. Follow your nose, as they say, right? Because the nose is always out in front. So the Rebbe Gamliel is called it's like a way of calling him the leader. I don't know. That's what Rashi says. It seems a little iffy. I saw that some say that it's a pun. You know, we do have examples of this, of a pun in one language that, when translated, loses some of its effect. So some say that, and as in Latin, nasotum means a nose or a big nose, and that sounds like nasi. Rabbi Gamliel was the nasi. So in Latin, you can make a loose pun to call him the with the nose. I'm not sure.
In English, you have like nasal and nose and the sea. It's not like such a stretch to make that kind of pun. You could do something like that. He was the.
Well, one second. Why are we saying Balach HaTem and not Balach HaTam?
You're right. It's Balach HaTam.
Some pronounce it HaTam.
The reason is that I had mistakenly mispronounced it.
The
sandals have this Chotem. Chotem?
Chotem. With a segol?
Yes.
Yeah. That's what Steinzel says. So David, in English.
Is that word used anymore? Is that word out of use?
No. It's the word for the nose.
Something used in everyday Hebrew.
Yes, but that doesn't prevent me from mispronouncing something.
I'm an
equal opportunity mispronouncer. Classical Hebrew, rabbinic Hebrew, biblical Hebrew, modern Hebrew, slang Hebrew. Just ask my kids, they'll tell you.
I guess coming from America. Wait,
David, you were suggesting another side.
I was just saying that you don't have to worry about your pronunciation of Latin. It just even in right. English we still have nasal, nose, those words also right. Were common. So, you could have a similar right. I mean so, words, if we were, etymology, if you could
we
have
were,
the same
if mode. We were staging this as a play in English and we wanted to preserve something of this particular pun, we could make Rabbi Gamliel be somebody who talks in a real nasally voice.
Or he's very nosy. He's the nosy of the
Sanhedrin. Oh, okay. Oh, right. Where's the nosy? Have the nosy guy. Right. The nosy guy has to run away. So anyway, he understood that he had to. That Rabbi Gamliel has to go and hide from the Romans. Azal gabe betzina. So that hegemon, that Roman official, goes to him in secret. Amarle, I matzalnia loch, if I save you, maititli la'al madati, if I save you, will you get me into Olam Haba? Amarle, hey, this Rabbi Gamliel says, sure. Amar, it's like a get out of jail free card. Amarle, eshtabali, swear to me that you'll get me into Olam Haba if I somehow get you off the hook. Eshtabali, he swore to him. Sleek igra nafal umate. So this hegemon goes up to the roof and he falls off, he jumps off, and he dies. Ugmiri dechigazre gzerta umate chad minaihu mivatle lagzerihu. apparently the custom in Rome was that if there's a decree that's put out, a death sentence, an execution sentence that's put out against someone, but a member of the, I'll call the Betin, the Roman court or the curia that issued the decree, if one of them dies before the execution is carried out, so then you get off the hook. For whatever reason, I'm not such a baki in first century or early second century Roman jurisprudence, but that was the law. That was the practice of Roman death sentences. So because of that, I mean, I guess we do have some parallels in other cases. Like, for example, very, very different case, and I'll add all the lahav deals. The idea that someone who is a horeg b'shogeg has to go to the ir miklat, and he stays there until the Kohen Gadol, who's somehow the authority over these things, until he dies, and then you get off the hook. So maybe this idea is somehow, maybe there's like a parallel of some sort. So this fellow, this hegemon, who was apparently one of the figures involved in putting out the execution order in the first place, he commits suicide, and therefore the gzeirah is canceled. And, you know, he does it, but he's guaranteed Olam Haba, that Rabbi Gamliel promises he'll get Olam Haba. Yatzta batkol v'amra, and a heavenly voice shouts out, Oto hegemon mizuman l'chai Olam Haba. Indeed, that hegemon is destined for the world to come.
Can I ask some questions about this?
Of course.
Okay, first, is this really, which Rabbi Gamliel are we talking about here? Rabbi Gamliel HaZakein? Or it can't be Rabbi Gamliel HaSheni, because he doesn't actually show up and start acting until 80 CE after Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is taken over.
In other words, the Gemara places this story at the time of Turnus Rufus, which is
Bar Kokhba time.
Yeah. So this is the end of the first beginning. This is probably you know, the first quarter of the second century.
Okay. So then it could be Rabbi Gamliel.
No, Turnus Rufus dies in 131 BC, 131 CE.
That would fit. Second, how could Rabbi Gamliel go around promising who gets a share in Olam Haba?
I don't know. But, you know, if your life was hanging by a thread and a guy says, I'll get you off the hook, but you got to promise to get me to Olam Haba, and you say, I promise, and even if you have to swear to it, I'm not sure that
the third thing. Then the Roman official proceeds to commit suicide for the purpose of canceling the decree? Doesn't the story sound awfully far fetched to you?
It might be something
other than what it says.
You know, I think that's a good working assumption for most agadot, but here,
like, make believe it's an agadot story. How would you deal with it?
Well, I don't have to worry about that, because I'm sure by the time we're done with the shir, I'll already have received two articles on the subject from you, Yehudi, and it'll fill me in with everything. If you haven't gotten to it before David did,
I want to hear what you have to say, not what other people. I can find that out anyway. But I want to hear what you have to say.
In other words, I think it's a portrait of this hegemon who was. Again, I don't know the details of what kind of judicial body would have put out the decree against Rabbi Gamliel, but he may have been, you know, you can think of all types of examples in film and in TV and in literature, let's say of a jury where, you know, we all saw 12 Angry Men, right? Right. So in other words, the way that scene was supposed to go before Jimmy Stewart turns the tide is that there's one guy who has doubts about the guilt of the person, but everybody else is sure that he's guilty, and the one holdout is railroaded into into voting guilt and execute him and hang him and put him in the electric chair. But yet he always has this kind of lingering doubt. He always has this kind of like, you know, feeling that they sent an innocent man away. And then he starts looking into it. You know, he starts investigating the records as the guy is rotting away on death row. And at the last minute, of course, in the Jimmy Stewart case in 12 Angry Men, it's Jimmy Stewart who gets the 11 people, the 11 other guys to change their mind. But in my case, so that one lonely holdout, you know, who votes to convict, even though he's not sure about it. So that guilt causes him to sometimes try to bring justice. So maybe that's what happens here. Maybe he felt he was railroaded into it. Maybe he was the youngest member of the court and the other members of the tribunal pressured him into it, but he felt it was wrong to execute Rabban Gamliel. So he tried to, you know, he was the Roman with the conscience. So he realizes the, he realizes that every member of the tribunal has a get out of jail free or get out of execution free card. Because if any one of that tribunal dies before the execution is carried out, the whole thing is canceled. So it's in his hands.
He voted against it. He was outvoted. The sentence was put down on Rabban Gamliel. And since he felt Rabban Gamliel was innocent, he goes to Rabban Gamliel and asks for a guarantee.
In my hypothetical, you asked me to imagine the Agnon story. In my hypothetical, he votes to convict him, but he does it under duress. And then feels guilty. If it's just a majority rule, so then the two voted to convict, he voted to acquit. So he did what he did, but the system worked however it worked. But if it's the kind of thing where you need a unanimous tribunal in order to convict, you know, which is often the case in capital cases where, you know, otherwise you have a hung jury. So maybe he was pressured into voting to convict, to execute, and he really believed that that was not the correct thing to do. And therefore, he realizes the only way to save this innocent man's life is to, I mean, it becomes a real redemption story, right? In other words,
if you think about it, if the man really wanted to just die for a principle, then he wouldn't sit there and go to Rabban Gamliel and say, guarantee me a share to Olam. I mean, that doesn't show you God dying for a principle. That shows you're only doing it because you're expecting to get some kind of a bigger reward. I mean, it doesn't. And in other words, there are elements of this story that essentially are contradicting themselves. But you're right. We should look into it more. I will do that. I was just curious as to how you took it.
Okay. Anyway, the Gemara goes on. Taru Rabbanan Mishacharav Habayit Rishona. This is a very famous agada. Taru Rabbanan Mishacharav Habayit Rishona Nitkatsu Kitot Kitot Shel Pirchei Kuhuna. When in Churban Bayit Rishon, the Pirchei Kuhuna are the junior Kohanim, the JV team, the youngsters, the young Kohanim. You know, like we have, like you know, you go up to Duchim. You know, when the Kohanim go up to Duchen, sometimes the little kid Kohanim go up to Duchen also. They're Duchening as Chinuch. And it's a question, like, if the only Kohen in the house is a seven-year-old kid, does he Duchen? Because when a seven-year-old kid Duchens, when he says Birkat Kohanim, it's not really Birkat Kohanim. In other words, like any child who does a mitzvah, it's Chinuch. It's to train him how to do the mitzvah. So if there are no adults that are saying Birkat Kohanim, do we let the little kids go up also? That's a separate halachic question, which we're not going to take up now. But the Pirchei Kohuna were the youngster Kohanim who would attend the Beit HaMikdash in order to observe what was going on. And sometimes, you know, like in shul, like they let the little, there's certain things we let the little kids do, right? We let them open the ark. We let them do Galila. We let them do Anam Zmirot. So I assume that's what they were doing. We didn't let them vote.
Are you sure that Pirchei Kohuna means 7-year-olds rather than 14 years?
I didn't say how old. I was giving an example from Shul, but they were young. They were the young Kohanim. They were the young Turks of the Beit HaMikdash. So when they go, when the Beit HaMikdash was being destroyed, these groups of the Pirchei Kohuna would gather together, umaftechot haheichal biyadan, and the keys to the temple are in their hand. Va'alu l'gag haheichal, and they go up to the roof of the heichal, the roof of the you know, the outer part of the holy, you know, next to the mizbeach.
Oh, wow, the heichal is a structure.
Right.
You're essentially on top of the temple itself.
You're at the tippy top, that highest point. That's it, looking right down on the mizbeach.
Okay, got it.
Right? Va'amru lefanav, and they say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono shel Olam, Master of the world, ho'il v'lo zachinu liyot gizbarin ne'manin, since we did not merit to be faithful treasurers, faithful watchmen of the Beit HaMikdash, yu maftechot misurin lacha, we return the keys back to you. V'zarkan klape mala, and they throw the keys up to heaven, v'yatzta k'ein pisat yad. It's as if, I mean, speaking metaphorically, whatever miracle is happening here, it's as if the hand of heaven reaches out, v'kiblatan mehen, and accepts the keys. V'heim kafzu v'naflu l'tocha ur. And they jump off the roof of the burning building into the fire, and they're killed.
Biblical Hebrew, I think the word gizbarim means custodians, not treasurers.
Okay.
That's the modern meaning of the word.
Yes.
Treasurers. But in a Tanakh, when that word is used, it means more like custodians. Fits custodians better with this.
Okay. Yeah, I said watchman. Also. Valet, well, in other words, a treasurer is a custodian of the funds.
Okay.
Valei and konen Yeshayahu and Avi, and on them, about them, Yeshayahu lamented Masa ge chizion, the
chizion,
the valley of the vision, ma loch efo ki alit kulach legagot. Why did you go up to the roofs? To shuot mle'a, it's full of tumult. Ir homia, a city that's all, again, tumult. These are synonyms for things are going awry. Kirya aliza, a joyous town. Chalalayich lo chalalei chariv. Right. That the people that are killed in this battle are even killed by swords. They're not even killed like in the normal way of war. Velo metei milchama, right? They're not killed in the normal course of the battle, but they're killed by going up to the roofs and jumping off into the fire. This is Yeshayahu Perek Kaf Beis 22. So Chazal understand this pasuk in Yeshayahu to be a hint to these pirchei kuna that died in this horrible, unusual way. Va'af b'kadosh baruch hu ne'amar mekarker kir v'sho'a el ahar. And regarding God himself, the pasuk continues that the trembling or the shouting of the walls and the cry of the mountain, the Harabayit itself is quaking and crumbling and weeping and wailing over what's happened. So this famous midrash has been used many times and many purposes throughout history. The evocative image of, excuse me one second, please. Apologies. This image of the Kohanim going up and throwing the keys up to heaven and the hands coming out and reaching them and them going down, jumping down, has been used many times. Perhaps in the 20th century, the most famous example is about the story of Rav Mordechai Weingarten. You see here on the screen, Mordechai Weingarten was the unofficial chief rabbi of the Old City at the time of Milchemet Atzmaut, at the time that the Old City falls to the Jordanians. And here he is being escorted out of the city by the Arab Legion. So in the days before the Old City falls, when the British are evacuating Jerusalem and are evacuating Eretz Yisrael, there's a story that's told at the very beginning of O Jerusalem. And it goes like this. It's not, you know, it's not exactly a parshanut on our Gemara, but it's well worth reading. They knew the sound. For months before this afternoon in May 1948, the forlorn wail had symbolized the frontiers of their existence. It was the skirl of British bagpipes, and now its call reverberated for the last time down these ancient stone passageways, piping away the few British soldiers left inside the old walled city of Jerusalem. They marched in columns, silent and unsmiling, the rhythmic tramp of their boots blending with the dying notes of the bagpipes. At the head and the rear of each column, one soldier, a Sten gun crooked in his elbow, broke the pattern of their unwavering stares, his restless eyes scanning the hostile stone facades around them. Along Rehov HaYehudim, you know, if you know the old city, Rehov HaYehudim, you know, right above the Cardo. From the sculptured stone windows of the synagogues and the mildewed hallways of their Bate Midrash, the bearded old men watched them go. Their ancestors had watched other soldiers march out of Jerusalem. Babylonians, Assyrians, Romans, Persians, Arabs, Crusaders, and Turks, the martial predecessors of these departing British soldiers, whose brief 30-year reign over Jerusalem was now ending. Rabbis, Talmidei Chachamim, interpreters of the law, pale and stooped from years of unremitting study, those old men and their forebears had huddled for centuries under the walls of Jerusalem and forgotten fragments of Jewry, living on the charity of their scattered brethren, caretakers of the Jewish heritage of the city of David. They had kept the Shabbat and conformed every action of their poor lives to the precise prescriptions of the law. They had memorized their Torah verses and painstakingly copied down the Talmudic texts they passed from generation to generation. And daily they had bowed before the stones of the Temple Mount, beseeching the God of Abraham to bring his people back one day to the land of Zion from which they had been cast. That day in May 1948, that day had never been so close. For other eyes, too, followed those British soldiers peering from sandbagged windows and concealed gun ports chiseled into the quarter's venerable stones. I mean, those of you that, you know the old city, you know, so much has changed in the old city, but so much of this description is, of course, you know, precise to even today's modern old city, the alt new city. Impatient with the ways of the divine, armed men stood poised to hasten the fulfillment of his prophecies. With the homemade hand grenades and Sten guns they clutched by their sides, as the last British soldiers disappeared, they would dash to seize the positions the Englishmen had held for months. A little string of vantage points sealing off the old city's Jewish quarter from the hostile Arab quarters surrounding it. Suddenly, as the last British column moved down the street, it stopped and veered left up a twisting cobblestone alley leading toward the vast domain of the Armenian Patriarchate. It stopped in front of the arched stones crowning the entry at number 3 Rehov Or HaChaim. You can go there to the building. You know, there are people who live there now. I'm sure it's a property that costs a lot of money, but then it was a rather modest domicile. Inside, surrounded by his collection of ancient Sfarim and silver Jewish artifacts, Rabbi Mordechai Weingarten, the senior citizen of the Jewish quarter, had passed the afternoon in the reassuring company of his sacred texts, lost in thought. He hesitated a moment at the knock on his door. He got up, put on his black vest and jacket, adjusted the gold-rimmed spectacles and his black hat, and stepped into the courtyard. There before Weingarten stood a middle-aged British major wearing the yellow and red insignia of the Suffolk Regiment. From his right hand dangled a bar of rusted iron, almost a foot long. With a solemn gesture, he offered it to the elderly rabbi. It was the key to Shar Tzion. Now, you know, like when you go into Shar Tzion, there are those, and also on Shar Yafo, they have the Sha'arim have doors that are, you know, not closed, although during Corona, there were pictures of the doors of Shar Yafo The gates of Shar Yafo closed because they were trying to limit passage in and out of the old city. So the doors technically can close and technically can be locked. And this long metal rusted piece of iron was the key to Shar Tzion, one of the seven gates of the old city of Jerusalem. From the year 70 AD until today, from Tisha B'Av, the destruction of the Second Temple, said the British soldier, a key to the gates of Jerusalem has never been in Jewish hands. This is the first time in 18 centuries that your people have been so privileged. Weingarten extended a trembling hand to accept the key. Jewish legend had held that on the night the Roman emperor, Titus, destroyed the temple, its despairing priests had thrown the keys of Jerusalem to heaven, crying, God, henceforth be thou the guardian of the keys. Now the improbable agent of their return to Jewish hands stood to attention and saluted. Our relations have not always been easy, he said, but let us part as friends. Goodbye and good luck. Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu melech olam, shechiyanu v'kiyamanu v'gyanu l'zman hazeh, murmured Weingarten. Then addressing the Englishman, he said, I accept this key in the name of my people. So you see how the Agadah is repurposed here. And I don't know, I've never been able to determine how much of the historical retelling of the story here in O Jerusalem is based on sources and whatnot. Do you understand that this is history where the author is putting into the minds of the characters different thoughts and feelings, which we can't really document? But let's imagine that this is really how it happens. It's a very powerful repurposing of the Agadah from our story, a tragic tale, to one of great hope and optimism, even though the possession of those keys, the return of Jewish sovereignty to the old city of Jerusalem, was at that moment very, very fleeting. Right? It would be 19 years until the Six-Day War, when we return to exercise sovereignty over the old city. And I'm not here getting into discussions of Inyone de Yoma and the propriety of Jews going up to Har HaBayit, which to me seems secondary to the importance of Jews having control and sovereignty over Yerushalayim.
Does Agnon ever use the image of those keys in a story? It sounds like the perfect thing. Agnon,
in Oreach Natal Alun, the central symbol is the key, and a guest for the night. And he makes reference to this Agadah in other places as well.
Okay.
There's another place among many others where the Agadah comes back. And that was, and I was there. I heard it with my own ears. I was present when it was said. And that was in coming up on almost exactly 30 years ago at the funeral for Rabbi Soloveitchik, Zichrono Levracha, his brother, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, now Zichrono Levracha, Shnehem, Zecher Tzadikim Levracha. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was the only hesped at the funeral, which took place in Maimonides in Brookline. David, were you there?
No, I hadn't gone back to Boston yet. I only came a few months later.
What year did you come to Israel?
I mean, I was in Israel from 1993, and then I was in Boston from 93 to 96, but I only came to Boston the summer of 1993.
So this was Erev Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach, 1993. And the only hesped was given by Rav Aaron. It's written up. You can read it. It's in this, you see this book, Memories of a Giant. They collected up all of the different hespedim that were said for the Rav, during the Shloshim and the Yoritzites and other things. They put them together. So the first one in the volume is Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's hesped. So he recalls that when the Rav was Maspid their father, this is 52 years earlier, the Rav had delivered the eulogy for Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the father of Rav Aaron and Rabbi Joseph B. in 1940. He said that when Reb Chaim Volozhiner passed away, his son, Rav Itzila Volozhiner, who replaced him in Volozhin, said to the Talmidim of Volozhin, in other words, Reb Chaim Volozhiner passes away. What did that mean for those students in the yeshiva? I mean, it was as probably as disheartening as the loss of any great rabbi is to his followers, be they misnagdim or chassidim. I mean, you remember, you know, like when the great rabbonim pass away, they have those funerals with hundreds of thousands, millions of people. You remember Rav Avadia's funeral? I remember Rav Moshe Feinstein in America in the 80s, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach here in 94, 95, I forget exactly when, Rav Avadia, Yosef, you know, these. It's not just because they have many followers, but there's this sense that with their passing, something is lost, something is transformatively changed in the fabric of existence. So when Reb Chaim Volozhiner, the founder of the yeshiva, the founder not just of Volozhin, but the founder of a whole new way of learning, passes away, his son, who replaces him as Rosh Yeshiva, which could have been no easy thing for a son to do, his son replaces him and turns to the Talmidim of Volozhin. Rav Aaron comments that at that time, Volozhin had very few Talmidim. I don't think it had 100 Talmidim. And Rav Itzela says to the orphaned students of Volozhin, the Midrash Eicha tells us that when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and was in flames, the Pirchei Kohuna, the young Bnei Torah in the Beis HaMikdash, went to its roof and threw up the keys. And they said to the Ribbono Shel Olam, we do not need these keys anymore. Please take them. And then a figurative hand came out from the heaven and grabbed the keys. Rav Itzela continued, you think that it was to the credit of the Pirchei Kohuna that they did this? Chas v'shalom. It was in criticism of the Pirchei Kohuna. That was the biggest blunder they could have ever done. If they hadn't thrown the keys into the fire, then in short time, with the required effort, they would have been able to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. That's Rav Aaron Soloveitchik quoting Rav Itzela Volozhin on the death of Rav Chaim Volozhin in the early 19th century. And then Rav Aaron says to those present, and I remember this, I was sitting not just, but 15 feet away when he said this. He said, don't repeat that blunder. I'm telling you now, not only to those who are assembled here, but to all the Bnei Torah in the United States and Canada and Israel and elsewhere, don't repeat that mistake. Don't throw the keys of the Beis HaMikdash Ma'at, the miniature temple of Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan of Yeshiva University, where Mishpachat Brisk has been influencing the lives of Bnei Torah since 1929. Don't throw away the keys into the fire. Keep the keys and rebuild the gates of the Beit HaMikdash Ma'at. He ends the eulogy for his brother, for the Rav, by recalling the death of Reb Chaim Volozhiner, by recalling the death of their father, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, which must have been a very transformative moment before the Rav became the Rav, before the Rav took over. And the death of Reb Chaim Volozhiner and the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the death of the Pirchei Kohuna as a sign of despair. And as he says, we're always inclined to despair in moments of crisis. Right? But the Jewish message is not to despair. Now, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was not a Chassidish Rebbe, but it's almost like he's saying, lo lefached klal. Right? In other words, as long as we keep the keys, which can be interpreted, I guess, metaphorically in different ways, as long as we keep the keys, there's hope that we go on. There's hope that we continue, that we can rebuild. But when you throw away the keys, like the equivalent of the English, you throw in the towel. When you throw in the towel, so then the fight is over.
Then so they how do you take the part about the can coming out of heaven to accept the keys?
No, because Hashem is saying, in other words, I don't know what Rav Aaron would say, but I imagine that what he means is that, in other words, Hashem says, you don't want them, I will be the guardian, but you're messing up, right? You're throwing away an opportunity, but I'm not going to abandon the Jewish people. There will be a time in the future where I will return the keys to the Jewish people, to a generation that can rebuild. Rav Aaron, of course, was a great Zionist. I don't know if he knew that story about Rav Weingarten, the old city. But one understands why Weingarten understood the symbolism of what this means, that the key here of Jewish sovereignty is being returned with the events leading up to Hey Iyar.
That was a great story, Rav Sachs.
But even though, of course, the actual keys to the old city become irrelevant for 19 years as it's taken away from us, but the keys to Jewish sovereignty are returned. Let's just a few more minutes. Let's try to make some space, to make some more room. The Gemara quotes the Mishnah. The Mishnah had said, "Mishenichnas Av mimatin besimcha." When the month of Av, in which we mark, of course, Tisha B'Av and the destruction of the temple, when that comes around, we diminish our rejoicing. Omar of Yehuda, Berei de Rav Shmuel, Bar Shilat, Mishmei de Rav, Keshem Mishenichnas Av Matin Besimcha, Kach Mishenichnas Adar, Marbin Besimcha, Misha, 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 Mishenichnas Adar. Turn the page. Daf Kaf Ted Amid Beis. Omar of Papas.
Near a historical note about Adar. You talked about Moshe Feinstein's funeral in New York, which was large. It was very large here in Israel too, and took place on Shushan Purim. It was like very surreal. The people came to with their kids, and the kids were in Purim costumes. It was really something unbelievable.
Right. Omar of Papa. Hilchach Bar Yisrael de it le dina bahade nochri le lishtamet mine ba'av. If you have an appointment, if you have a judgment, if you have a court case in the non-Jewish court during Av, it's better to try to get out of it. It's better to try to delay it. All things being equal, if you can avoid perilous situations here, I guess epitomized as having to be called to judgment in a non-Jewish court, which, you know, for Chazal, for rabbis, for the Rishonim also, and for many of the Achronim, was like a symbol of a place a Jew did not want to be. Because altogether, you're not going to get a fair shake. And so much more so during Av, Derea Mazle, because you have bad luck. We have a bad mazel during Av. You don't want that tipping the scales against you. The Limtsi Nafshe Ba'adar, De varie mazle, but you should try to make it happen in Adar, because that's when the stars are aligned in order to make judgment work on our behalf. So there are luckier times and there are less fortunate times, and if you can, you should try to organize your affairs around those events. All right, so we'll pause there and we'll continue next week. Let me just check the calendar. Next week, I think, yes, we have Shiur next week and the week after, and then we run into wedding things. We will have to let you know. I think I've mentioned that our son is getting married at the beginning of December. Thank you. So, but at least the next 2 weeks, we should be on, you know, probably still on Web Yeshiva. Perhaps I'll try to make another one or two little recordings, because I really want to finish up Ta'anit before we go back to meeting in person. Okay, thank you all very much. Laila Tov.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye.